coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
I've done ketamine now, I think, 3 or 4 times and different doses. And the big dose, I just really left for, I guess, about 30 minutes. And what I got from that, which I think a lot of people say, but it was striking to me, was before I kind of believed that there was something beyond this life, you know, that when you die, you go to a good place or something like that. But now I know. It's because I was there. And it's great. It's very blissful. And I'd had no boundaries. I was totally in it. And when I came back, people who were there were saying, what I was saying was, I don't want to leave. This is a really hard place I'm coming back to. And it is. It's made me realize how hard it is to be in these bodies and to be so separate from each other. And yeah, it had a pretty profound impact.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Dick Schwartz. Dick is the founder of a style of psychotherapy called Internal Family Systems. IFS is based on the idea that the mind is made up of discrete subpersonalities and that healing occurs when they are brought into harmony. Dick is bullish about psychedelics as a way of accessing and understanding these different subpersonalities, or parts as they are called. And he believes that IFS can be a helpful topography for anyone doing psychedelic-assisted therapy. On the show, we discuss the IFS system and why it's particularly good for working with trauma. Dick shares his personal experiences with psychedelic medicines, and I share my own spontaneous IFS work during an iboga journey. We talk about how IFS can inform psychedelic-assisted therapy and why a knowledge of parts is important for the therapist. We talk about indigenous wisdom traditions and the spirit guides of the DMT world. As always, we conclude with Dick's specific advice to the aspiring psychedelic therapist. It is an honor to speak to such an affable and studied luminary in the field of psychology, and we are excited to bring you other perspectives beyond the traditional psychedelic community moving forward. One important note: this podcast, Maya, and I personally support the Black Lives Matter movement. We recognize that the psychedelic renaissance has challenges with diversity, and we commit to continuing to platform the enormous gifts of BIPOC communities, as well as subjects like equal access to psychedelic medicine, healing ancestral trauma, and social justice on this podcast. There are many brilliant melanated voices carrying psychedelic wisdom. If you'd like to nominate a guest for this show, please let us know in the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group. And now, here's Dick Schwartz, founder of Internal Family Systems. Well, let's just take a moment to arrive here with each other. Okay. Do you prefer Dick or Richard?
Dick.
Okay. Nice to see you. Nice to meet you. Really a pleasure to be here. And it was so fun listening to you with Jonathan Van Ness.
Good.
I was reviewing that podcast on the drive from my partners over to here. Mm-hmm. And he does such a wonderful job of making things accessible mm-hmm. by being silly himself. And I really like his interview style. I mean, he's not like a podcaster in the way of like going deep with these sort of probing, informed questions per se.
Right.
But he knows what he's talking about, and he's so playful, he kind of like gets you off guard a little bit. And it's really cool.
And he's self-disclosive too, which really helps.
So. I think that's the name of the game for podcasting. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to show up as the human that you are, mm-hmm. you're going to get the real deal from other people. Mm-hmm. And those are so much more interesting conversations to listen to. And And that's part of why I was really excited that you were interested and willing to discuss your own relationship to psychedelics during our conversation today. Sure. Because I'm sure that people listening would be thrilled to know that this is territory that you yourself have explored. Mm-hmm. So I have a whole beautiful roadmap here that we do not need to follow with any level of seriousness. But one thing that I like to check in with at the beginning of a podcast is, where would you most be excited to get to today? The idea that there are people who aspire to be psychedelic therapists, there may be traditional therapists who are interested in psychedelics, maybe some people who practice IFS who know you and your work. Considering this sort of broad audience, what would be the big exciting win for you today on the show?
Yeah, I think the biggest win for me would be if it was another step in the direction of IFS becoming a kind of map to that territory, psychedelic territory. That's a sizable goal for me now. And made some inroads, but you know, this is another opportunity.
And when did that become a goal for you?
You know, it's been a while because in the very early days of this renaissance of psychedelics, one of my students, Michael Mithoffer, started getting into the MDMA thing. And I kind of followed what he was doing the whole time. And he was incorporating a lot of IFS into it. And that was exciting to me because it seemed like in taking the MDMA, people could access a lot of what I call self very quickly. And all their protective parts would kind of retire for 8 hours or however long. And then they would also begin to access other parts that they wanted to work with and would spontaneously start doing that without any cueing from the therapist. And so I got excited about the potential of combining them and talked a lot with Michael about it. And he kept track in the early days of the studies of how often that happened, where spontaneously people would start doing IFS. And it was like 70% of the time with this population of PTSD survivors. And so anyway, I got intrigued early on in the early days and have stayed that way. And then I wound up, for various reasons, working with some casualties of psychedelic therapies or psychedelic experiences. And it felt like if only the guide had known some of this and hadn't panicked themselves or had, you know, knew enough to help the subject relate differently to whatever was coming up, they wouldn't have had this psychotic episode, or they wouldn't have had this panic attack or whatever it was. And so then I started to, you know, to think I really needed to commit some energy to trying to help people understand this inner world better.
So the IFS modality could be looked at as an important aspect of a psychedelic therapist's toolkit. And perhaps psychedelics as a modality for therapy may be useful for the IFS practitioner. So there's sort of tools on both sides. The first question I would have in terms of what you've just described here is, when you're speaking about psychedelic-assisted therapy and IFS, have you only really been looking at MDMA, or have you been looking at other psychedelics, for example, psilocybin or ketamine-assisted therapy?
Yeah, it's mainly those three. There's a woman named Lou Lucas at the University of Nebraska who's a physician and is working with people who are about to die, you know, similar to the Johns Hopkins work, and is collaborating with those guys. But this time is going to use IFS as the framework, along with psilocybin, and is going to do an outcome study with that, for example. With MDMA, there's a guy named Bart Rubin in the Bay Area who is going to fund a study with MAPS on IFS and shame. So that's in the planning stages. And then there is this guy I mentioned to you earlier, Bob Grant in the Bay Area, who's using IFS and ketamine a lot and is a good researcher and is planning to do a study with IFS and ketamine too. My distinctions have been MDMA allows you to stay in your body and access self and stay in the present, basically. Ketamine, for sure, takes you to some other non-dual realm, I guess depending on the dose. And you leave your body. You're not around here. But when you come back and you start to embody, there's a lot of self. So that's the point where Bob and other people using it start to help people work with their parts. And then psilocybin is similar in that it doesn't, you don't leave, I don't think, as much or as far as you do with ketamine, but you're definitely not necessarily in your body I don't know if you would agree with that, but you're accessing a lot of self.
Well, I think different journeys take you to different places, certainly.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to talk about some different psychedelics in our conversation today. Also because I've done extensive work with ayahuasca and as well as iboga. Not extensive work with iboga, but my biggest psychedelic informed parts work so far in my life spontaneously was actually on iboga, which is what the extraction ibogaine comes from. So that's a little teaser for later in the conversation because I'd love to share that experience and get your perspective on it.
Sure.
But I think for the listener, let's just start with just really basic. What is IFS and why is it so helpful in dealing with trauma especially?
Okay. So it's a different paradigm for understanding the mind and human nature that asserts that we are all multiple personalities in the sense that we all have these parts, what I call parts, other systems call subpersonalities, or some of them are other words like schema or internal objects and so on. But those don't, for me, do justice because neither is the word part, really, because for me, these are inner minds. They're inner beings, in a sense, sacred inner beings that are here to help us in our lives and contain wonderful, valuable resources and talents and can be of great assistance to us. And what we call thinking often is just there interacting behind the scenes. And so we're born that way. It's the natural state of the mind to be subdivided that way. And then we run into traumas or what's called attachment injuries, where you get hurt by a parent. And these parts are forced out of their naturally valuable states into roles that can be destructive. But we're needed often at the time when you were young and had to protect, the part thought it had to protect you that way. And then these parts get frozen in time in those traumas. So they live as if it's still happening or it's about to happen again. And they pick up what I'm going to call burdens, which are extreme beliefs and emotions that came into you from the trauma, from the attachment injury, and attach to these parts and drive them almost, if you pardon the expression now, like a virus. And so a lot of the healing happens when you get the part out of where it's stuck in the past and you witness what happened to it, and then you can unload the burdens it carries, literally send them out of your system, at which point the part will transform into its naturally valuable state. So that's the first assumption. And as you can imagine, it's been a tough sell in this psychotherapy field and to the world. And then the second one's been an even tougher sell, and that I just stumbled onto because I'm a family therapist. So once I got hip to the fact these parts aren't what they seem, because at first I thought the critic was just an internalized critical voice of a parent, and I would get my client to fight with it, and that would make it stronger, but I didn't know what else to do. Or the binge, I would get them to try and control, and it would get worse, but I didn't know what else to do. And then trial and error, I learned that was a big, big mistake. and that all you need to do is listen to them, and they'll tell you how they got forced into their roles and how much they hate the role, how much they'd love to get out of it if they thought it was safe. So anyway, I learned that, and then I'm trying to get my clients now to listen to the part and be nice to it rather than fight with it. And let's say I'm doing that with your critic, and I'm asking you to, you know, just talk to the critic a little and get to know it. And suddenly, Eamon, you're furious with the critic. And it occurred to me, like in family sessions where I'm having two people talk to each other and one gets furious with the other, you look around the room and you see somebody else in the family is siding covertly with the one who's getting furious. And we were taught to get that person to move out of that person's line of vision in the room, step back in the room, and then they calm down and they have a decent dialogue. So just protecting the boundary around that dyad. Maybe the same thing's happening in this inner system. So I began asking, Eamon, could you find the part that just came in and is so angry at the critic? And could you ask it to just step back? And let's just ask it if it'll let you get to know this critic rather than fight with it. And you would say, okay, it did. Now how do you feel toward the critic? And you would say, I'm just kind of curious about why it calls me names. Seconds earlier, you hated it, wanted to get rid of it, or you were terrified of it. And just by getting those parts to open space, it seemed to release this whole other person in there who, in addition to being curious, was calm and confident and had compassion for the critic, or clarity, saw it very differently now, or had creativity in how it related to the critic. Or so these, as you're getting, are C words that characterize what I'm calling self. And by just getting these parts to open space inside, it releases this self that's in everybody with a capital S. And that self knows how to heal. It knows how to relate to your parts in a loving way. And it knows how to relate to people in the outside world in a loving way. So I was going over what we call the 8 C's of self-leadership. And I think I got through 5 or 6. And then there's also courage. So now you have the courage to go to places inside that you were terrified of before. And connectedness. So that you have a sense of being far more vastly connected to the world, to humans, to the earth, to whatever you want to call the big stuff. And you have a desire to connect even more, to connect with people more, with your parts more. So that's who you are beneath the surface of these parts. And when they open space, you just pop out that way. And as I did that with more and more people and found the same thing happening, I started to get excited, because what if this was true? What if this is who we really are? What if everybody has this just beneath the surface? And it turns out now, thousands of clients later, thousands of therapists using this all over the world, that we can pretty safely say that that's true, that this is who everybody is. And it can't be damaged, and it will emerge spontaneously once parts open space for it. And that's what I think these medicines are doing. They're helping you access that. And the other side of this is, as I really studied this, I started to think of quantum physics. Because in quantum physics, there is this strange, can't be explained by science phenomena that photons, like little particles of light, are simultaneously both a wave and a particle. And because what I was finding was, when you're embodied, when yourself is in your body, you have boundaries and you feel separate. You know, you still feel some level of connectedness, but you have autonomy and you're a separate person. And you lead inside and outside. But when you take these medicines, some of them, or you meditate in a big way, you leave the separateness and often leave the body, and you enter the non-dual, and you're in that wave state where there isn't boundaries. And then you come back into your particle state. And for me, it's the same self that goes up there and then comes back down here. This is a particleized, I invented that word, version of what's up there, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Not only does it make sense, it definitely maps onto my experiences of the interconnectedness of that non-dual realm. And it makes me think about some of the research around the default mode network. The research that they were doing at Imperial College London, where they did fMRI scans of the brain under the influence of LSD and found decreased activity in this space called the default mode network, and then increased activity amongst other sort of regions and networks. And it seems like perhaps the structure, the way that the parts interact with each other to kind of hold all of each other in place, that could be the default mode network. That seems to map pretty well to that. Have you looked into that aspect of it from the perspective of IFS?
Yeah, I haven't done that research. I mean, I haven't, I want to. I would love to do brain scan research with parts, but my guess is that there are a lot of what we call manager parts that are using that default mode network, and what spirituality derogatorily calls the ego is that. And then for whatever reason, the medicine shuts down those managers and suddenly you're non-dual. Suddenly you're totally oceanic and expansive. And it makes sense to me that that would be the case.
And this would be a good time to check in about your own personal experiences. Have you had an experience either with a psychedelic or in meditation? Have you personally been in that non-dual oceanic realm?
Yeah, with ketamine I have, for sure. And I, you know, I did TM for 8 years after college and would have times like that, for sure. So I wasn't too scared of it. I knew how pleasant it was, kind of blissful. But with ketamine, I've done ketamine now, I think, 3 or 4 times and different doses. And the big dose, I just really left for, I guess, about half an hour. And what I got from that, which I think a lot of people say, but it was striking to me, was before I kind of believed that there was something beyond this life, you know, that when you die, you go to a good place or something like that. But now I know it's because I was there, and it's great. It's very blissful. And I'd had no boundaries. I was totally in it. And when I came back, people who were there were saying, what I was saying was, I don't want to leave. This is a really hard place I'm coming back to. And it is. It's made me realize how hard it is to be in these bodies and to be so separate from each other. And yeah, it had a pretty profound impact. There was a second time I took a lower dose and I didn't totally leave my body. I could sense still my body, and I didn't become totally non-dual either. And people watching were saying, wow, there is a self. Wow, I'm still here. You know, and I kind of marveled at that. So, yeah, those are the times where I got into that state the most.
And in your own experience, have you only used ketamine to have these experiences, or have you had an experience with MDMA or psilocybin thus far in your journey?
I've had a MDMA experience, and it was very evocative. I mean, I did get into the open-hearted place where I was in love with my guide and with my wife, and just, you know. But then a lot of other stuff started coming through me, stuff that was clearly not mine, and some of that, it wasn't disturbing to me. But it was disturbing to my guide because I was doing strange things. I was, you know, it was like I was being raped for a while, and that I'm certain that's never happened to me. But, you know, things like that were coming through me, and I really don't know why. So it wasn't as pleasant a trip. But I expect I'll do it again.
When you say stuff that wasn't yours, it just felt like you were having an experience that didn't relate to your own life experience that came from some unknown place.
Yeah.
If it's not yours, whose stuff was it?
I'm not sure, but you know, there is stuff floating around that can come through you. So when I explored it more with someone who knows a lot more of the shamanic world, they said that, you know, that's kind of what happens sometimes. So I opened some kind of portal, apparently, and the stuff was piling through.
It's interesting. I haven't had an experience like that with MDMA. For me, at least, MDMA has been an experience that's been very heart-centered and a lot of safety. The biggest thing for me with MDMA is safety. It's such an incredibly safe experience. And you were mentioning earlier attachment wounds. I have an anxious attachment style, and a lot of my personal suffering has to do with attachment. And so when my partner and I are able to have an MDMA experience to explore our connectedness, all of a sudden, all of my protectors that make her the bad guy, that they all disappear. And I can see so clearly that she has nothing but love for me. And that wounded part of myself that I have been fighting so hard to keep her away from gets to actually connect with her in a much deeper way, which is what I've really wanted. And I think with the parts work, and of course, as I've mentioned, I'm doing parts work in my own therapy, it's so fascinating how these parts of yourself, they love you. They want to serve you. Like the whole system inside yourself, everybody's just doing their best. But these parts, as you said, were frozen at a certain time where they believed that their job was to do this thing that's now no longer serving you. And for me, with MDMA especially, the threat is just not there in the same way. Mm-hmm. Something is happening in the pharmacology of my brain. And maybe, you know, my amygdala is suppressed. And I don't actually know the science of it. Perhaps you do.
No.
But that threat where it's like this woman is close to me and it's like threat. What if she says something? What if, you know, all these things, it just completely melts away. And I find myself just totally open to her as she is, which is a very, very liberating experience for that core wound of mine.
Yeah. And what, Michael and others who are using MDMA with IFS are doing is, in addition to helping you connect with her, to help you start to connect with that wounded part.
Mm.
And while you're in so much self from the medicine, and actually then what we call unburden it, help it out of where it's stuck and unload the pain, and then bring in all the protectors to see now they don't have to protect it anymore. And they can take on new roles. And then you won't have to only feel that love for her or from her when you're doing MDMA.
So I'd love to share with you my spontaneous IFS experience.
Sure.
Because I had never done IFS therapy at all. And I did Iboga with the Bwiti people in Gabon. Are you familiar with Iboga?
Not really.
Okay, so Iboga is a West African psychedelic. It lasts a very long time, and it is most known in the West because its extraction, ibogaine, is really efficacious for addiction treatment. So a lot of people who are trying to come off of opiates, they've found that ibogaine is incredibly powerful for that. Its traditional cultural setting is with the Bwiti people who are in the Congo Basin, especially Gabon in Africa. And amongst my journeys, I went to Gabon and I did Iboga with the Bwiti.
Wow.
Super, super exciting and very hard experience. And I had a spontaneous IFS experience where we were speaking about the critic. My critic has been a drill sergeant, and I had none of this framework. But in that space, and this was a 48-hour journey, and in the depths of it, there was a lot of just memories, childhood memories coming up. But I had this moment where I met this part of my psychology. I directly met it, like I was speaking to it. And it was this kind of old drill sergeant character who had been saying, you got to do it this way, you got to do it this way, you got to do it this way. And I was like, hey, this isn't really working. Like, I get what you're trying to do, but maybe we could do it another way. And this part of me that I was talking to was like, well, you know, I'm not really liking this either. And I was like, okay, well, what do you want to do? And he's like, I just want to keep you safe. And I was like, well, look, we're in kind of like an advanced technological age. Why don't I like upgrade you to like a systems protection? So you don't have to be like a grunt drill sergeant yelling orders. You can be like behind the scenes with the computers and the surveillance, just checking and making sure I'm safe. And if I'm not safe, you can let me know. And it was so fascinating because I was totally interfacing with this part of me. And he was so happy to like have this promotion. What I was doing, which I'd never done before in my own psychology, which I was being kind to a part of myself that I'm usually in conflict with, inviting a promotion and then watching like my whole psychology kind of like resettle. And it's not like it totally changed and I completely lost any kind of critic, but something seismically shifted in my being. And it was completely spontaneous in a medicine journey.
Yeah, well, that is, like I was saying, that's what Michael Medhoffer found and still finds. Because they're not allowed to guide, really. And so spontaneously, people would have the exact same experience you describe. And for me, that was just, it was just validating, you know. It made me feel like, okay, I stumbled onto something that we know how to do once we access enough self. Inherently, it's just an inherent healing process that we have. And that we've, you know, in the outside world, in the regular world, we've just got that all screwed up because we think we have to fight with all these inner beings. So that's great. And that's what we find over and over is these critics, once relieved of their duties, want to just be advisors. They like it. They want to just be your, you know, your wise little friend in your ear. So,
for you personally, have you gone through a process where you've upgraded and reframed your relationship to these different parts in yourself?
Oh my God, yeah, I've been doing it for 40 years almost. Yeah, things are totally different for me. It
seems like it would be a process that is nonlinear but ongoing with certain leaps and bounds. Is that kind of the way the process works?
Very much. I mean, it varies. Some people, it's all leaps and bounds, but most of us, it's, you know, you get into what I call one clove of the garlic, which is one, a couple exiles and a bunch of protectors surrounding them. And why I call it a clove of the garlic is it's not that connected to these other cloves that are around other traumas. And you begin to heal that. And, you know, that might take some time. And you finally do clean all that out. You unburden all the parts. And now that particular area of your life is very different. But you didn't touch these other cloves that still need attention. So that's kind of how it goes. So, yeah.
You just mentioned exiles, and I'm not fully sure about the full architecture of the internal family system, but I am familiar with, in my own experience, the idea of kind of exiling a part of myself. For example, you were talking about shame earlier, and something that's been really important in my work, separate from the psychedelic healing space, but I've done a lot of men's work, and there's a lot around male shame and male sexual shame, and especially in an era with, you know, a lot of the ways that people are experiencing sexuality being through pornography, for example. My experience growing up was that there were aspects of my sexuality that I exiled, that I said, I don't want this to be a part of me and I'm going to put it away. And then I learned as I got older that you can't exile any part of yourself, that by pushing away an aspect of yourself, that aspect actually kind of grows on its own and that you have to reintegrate it to be in a harmonious kind of healed state. Is that what you mean when you're talking about an exiled piece?
Yeah. So as we go through these traumas and attachment injuries, the parts that are the most hurt by those experiences tend to be these inner children who, before they got hurt, are delightful and playful and creative and loving and open and trusting. But after they get hurt or they feel very shamed or they feel terrified, and they're the ones who feel those things the most because they're the most sensitive parts of us. After that happens to them, we don't want to be around them anymore because they have the power to pull us into those experiences. And so we naturally try to lock them away inside in inner basements or abysses or caverns and just keep them there. And so that's what I'm calling the exiles. And then, so it's insult to injury for these parts. They get hurt and then they get rejected by you and abandoned by you and locked away. And so then they start to get more and more upset and either totally desolate and you know, wanting to give up or more and more trying to break out. And so, and then the world will still trigger you, trigger an exile, and then they do break out. And then it's this big psychic crisis. And I think that's some of what happens with psychedelics. It opens the door to the exiles sometimes. And then people panic because they think they're having a panic attack or they think they're having some kind of shame attack or something like that. And unless you think of it, oh, it's great. Here's an exile that I can work with. Then you tend to blend with it and become it. So, yeah, so that's very similar to what you described as your exile. There's another. So when you get a bunch of exiles, the world becomes more dangerous. You become more delicate. So you have to have all these other protective parts that are trying to keep the exiles from being triggered, as you described, like with your partner. And some of them are trying to manage everything, control the world. So, you know, control how close she gets to you, control how you look, control how you perform sexually, whatever. So these we call manager protectors. And then despite their best efforts, you still get triggered. Exile still gets, and flames of emotion can engulf you. So there's another set of parts we call firefighters whose job it is to deal with those flames. And they'll try to get you higher than the flames or they'll try and distract you till you it burns itself out. So we call them firefighters. And we've all got a bunch of those. And, you know, drug addicts would have that as their getting higher than the pain, firefighter activity. And so there's all kinds of different firefighter activities, including suicide, which is often the top of the hierarchy. So that's the map. Now, there is a class we call protectors in exile. So let's say sexuality became your firefighter, but you were acting out with it and getting in trouble, or you know, you couldn't stand how it was constantly consuming you. So your managers lock it up too. Now it's become a protector in exile as opposed to an exile, which is a vulnerable part that got hurt.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the right distinction for the example that I was bringing up. So, and I know we're getting a little bit into just my personal life, but that's fine. Yeah. But I think that for me, yeah, I think that my experience of sexual fantasy as an adolescent was, as you say, that was like a firefighter. Because that was a way of kind of escaping from an experience and being able to go into a space of control. But then my shame and judgment around sexual fantasy then was managed by exiling that. And so to unwind that experience was to bring that exiled protector back into my consciousness so that I could go into the deeper vulnerable pieces that firefighter was protecting against?
Yeah, that's right. And that's how IFS works. We learn the hard way to start with protectors, not to go to exiles right away. Mm. And we go to the protector, not expecting it to change, actually, in the beginning, but more to honor it for its service. Even if it's screwing up your life, it's trying its best to do something because it thinks you need it. And then to learn what it protects, what's the exile it's protecting, and then negotiate permission with the protector to go and heal the exile, which can sometimes take a while because they're really afraid often to open that door. Because whenever they did in the past, you know, you didn't get out of bed for a week or something like that. So that can be a tough sell sometimes, but we know all the fears the protectors have and we know the way to address those fears in general. So we can get them to open the door. We go to the little boy inside of you and she's stuck in some trauma scene, and I would have you go to him, be with him in the way he needed somebody back there, and then get him out to a safe place, at which point he's open now to unload the beliefs and emotions, the burdens he's been carrying from that time. And we have a ritualized way of doing that. So we send it out to light or water or fire, something like that. It's more shamanic. And then the boy will immediately transform into his naturally valuable state. You want to go play, something like that. And then we bring in the sexual protector and all the other protectors to see now this boy is okay. They don't have to do this anymore. And we help them into new roles, just like you did with your critic. Now, it might be that he couldn't do it all the time because you hadn't healed the exile that he protects. So if he came and saw, okay, this boy is okay. I don't have to push you like this. I can just be the advisor now.
I'm curious. It makes a lot of sense that the therapist who is doing psychedelic therapy would be really well aided to have this landscape of IFS. Do you think that the patient, the client, the journeyer, do you think that it would be good for them to familiarize themselves with this landscape prior to having a psychedelic experience to better negotiate it from that perspective? Or is it the type of thing that perhaps it would be too suggestive to their psychedelic experience if they went into it attempting to do their own IFS work? Mm-hmm. Is it good for the therapist to use the IFS system for the patient, or should someone of their own accord use this modality on themselves?
You know, it's a really good question. I haven't maybe thought it through entirely. It's very good for the guide to have this map and to not panic. But if still the participant doesn't know to think of it as just a part, it's still going to be very scary for that person. So I think it would help if they were both in on it. And I don't think, because I, you know, the times I've done it, I know the model inside and out, and still I wasn't doing it when I was tripping. I was doing what I was doing. I don't think it necessarily is going to influence your journey to know the model. So, you know, I think it probably would be helpful for both. The other very helpful thing for the guide or the facilitator is to know his own parts or her own parts to also know how to stay in self while they're with the participant. And that is something we teach in our trainings. And it's a very teachable skill, because parts, when they come up, have very distinct kinds of energies. And they come up in distinct places in your body. And also, when you get into self, there's a very much of a felt body sense of that. So I'm checking, if I'm with somebody in a session, you know, I don't do psychedelic sessions, but if I'm with somebody in an IFS session, I'm frequently checking, is my heart open? Do I have an agenda here? Is this vibrating energy that I'm used to, we call self-energy, is that flowing through my body? What's my tone of voice? So these are the ways I check to see, am I in self? And if I can stay in self, everything just flows and it's effortless. And I would suspect the same is true for when you're facilitating psychedelics. And yeah.
You know, that I'm so happy that you brought that up. I'm not personally a psychedelic therapist. I'm a podcast host and psychedelic enthusiast, but I've done a lot of psychedelic peer support. Are you familiar with psychedelic peer support? It's also called trip sitting.
No.
So there's a group called the Zendo Project, which is part of MAPS, and they create a safe space at places where people typically do recreational psychedelics, i.e. festivals or other events, where you can receive psychedelic peer support, and they actually train you to be able to support someone having a difficult psychedelic experience. So if, say, I'm at a festival and I've taken some acid and it's triggering a part in me, and there's you know, all sorts of things are going on. There's a lot of chaos. I can go to this place, the Zendo Project, the Zendo Tent, and someone who is sober and has been trained to hold space will sit with me for, you know, a number of hours. And I've done this training and I've done this work. And it makes me think a lot of what you've just said in terms of what your responsibility is to, quote, hold space, i.e., you can't have an agenda. You can't try to fix someone. Right. You have to be present. You model a peacefulness to them. Mm-hmm. You, instead of saying, oh, you have to breathe, you breathe, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of hold that. And it makes me think a lot of what you were saying about, for the psychedelic therapist, being really attuned to your own wise self, because the inner healing that is occurring for your patient who's under the who's having the journey is best facilitated in many cases by your own sort of sense of harmony, that harmony can be attuned between you and that person having the experience.
Yeah. The way I phrase it is self is contagious. So,
ooh, I like that.
Yeah. So if I'm in self, it's going to be like, you know, the tuning forks that if you set one off across the room, that it's the same frequency, the other will spontaneously start going. So if I can be in self, I'm going to create that self energy in the room atmosphere that feels very safe. And not just through my words and so on, but just through my energy. And that relaxes protectors. And a lot of the problems that people have when they're going into these realms is they encounter scary parts, and then their protectors react to what they found, and they get scared. So it's the fear of the fear that's really the problem a lot of the time. So if I can stay in the way you're saying that these people do in the tent, just calm and soothing, and then also help them see it's just a part. It's not a psychotic process. It's just a part. Then everything calms down. They separate from the part instead of being totally overwhelmed by it. And they can actually do some work with it at that point.
You mentioned towards the beginning of the conversation, casualties of psychedelic experiences. And I think as we're in this psychedelic renaissance space and we're moving towards understanding these powerful molecules as medicines that have so much healing and so much to teach us, there's also this story of the kind of burnt out hippies, the folks who in the 60s and 70s took too much and kind of went away and never came back. And so there's some fear that a psychedelic experience could trigger schizophrenia or could lock someone in a state that, you know, that could cause just lasting harm. And I'm curious, because you mentioned it at the beginning of the conversation, if you've worked with people who have had psychedelic experiences that have caused harm, and if you can, for the aspiring psychedelic therapist listening to this particular conversation, if you could give some kind of advice and suggestions around how you've seen that happen, how you've seen that to be resolved, and what people should be aware of around the fact that psychedelics can, in certain cases, actually cause harm.
Yeah, it's not that different than what I just said, which is this is opening a door to your inner world that you can traverse pretty safely in a lot of different places in it. But there are closets and there are trapdoors and there are exiles, and they can come flooding in because they're seizing the opportunity. You've locked them up for 30 years and they've been dying to take over. They think they have to totally take over or else they're going to be locked up again. So they'll come rushing out and overwhelm, and then other protectors will panic at that. And then that starts a vicious cycle that it's kind of a downward spiral. And so the clients I've worked with have come in pretty bad shape. And I just start to unpack that and help them know this isn't a panic attack. No, this isn't a psychotic break. It's just a part. Let's get to know it. Let's learn about why it took over, what it's afraid would happen if it didn't do that. And then let's work with all the parts that are terrified of it, or the parts that, and there's a what I call a law of inner physics that comes in really, really handy those times, which has never been violated in the almost 40 years I've been doing this. You curious?
Yes, I am. What is the law of inner physics?
So the law of inner physics is that there's nothing inside of you that has any power if you're not afraid of it.
Ooh, okay. I'll believe that. I mean, there's a lot of things that I can get afraid of. Yeah. But if I wasn't afraid of it, what's the power if you're not afraid of it?
It has no power. And so if I were working with you and you saw something you were terrified of, I would say, Eamon, let's see if we can get all those scared parts into a kind of waiting room that's safe and see if they'll really just give us a chance to work with this monster in there. And you would do that, and now how do you feel toward the monster? And now you say, I'm just kind of interested in why it's doing what it does. Okay, let's get to know it. And ultimately, it's got no power. You can help it totally transform. So just that by itself, just that piece of knowledge, if you can get somebody in self, there's nothing to fear.
Yeah, every conversation that I have had with people who really understand the psychedelic space, there's always the piece of safety that comes up. You know, the key consideration of a psychedelic experience is, what is the set and setting? And we live in a climate where people have been experimenting with psychedelics in a place that's unsafe because it's illegal. And, you know, we culturally don't have those safe spaces. That's part of why the Zendo tent is so important. It's a physically safe space. It's away from the music. It's away from the chaos. There's, you know, some nice cushions, place to sit down. But it seems so much of healing is around creating safety so that the inner healer can work and those tight spaces in us can begin to naturally unwind, because they're held, I believe, in myself at least, they're held by our fear. And I think psychedelics and I think MDMA, for me at least, is really powerful for this feeling of like, oh, I'm safe. Okay, it's not so scary. Like, it's all going to be okay. And yeah, that really resonates a lot. And I like that as kind of a North Star, to say that, you know, there's no power without fear in these different spaces inside us.
That's right. And, you know, I think in general, the MDMA is probably the least of the scary ones. Although I've worked with a few people that had really scary things happen, even on MDMA. So, and I totally agree with you that, you know, part of why it was outlawed for so long is because of the misuse and the casualties. And we don't want to, you know, go through that again. Just as we're getting to legalization, at least with MDMA, there's the potential that it's going to the backlash. And that's why Michael and MAPS have been so, so careful and so, so upfront about everything and so careful about set and setting. And I really support that. And part of the set and setting, I would hope, is this energy that the facilitator can bring.
And that's very much our listeners today. You know, that is the responsibility of those who wish to take on this work, is to, you know, you really have to be working on your own stuff and you know, you want to clear your vessel as much as possible. This is something that I've found with ayahuasca shamans. Good ayahuasca facilitators have worked very hard to clean their vessels.
That's right.
So that they can hold a space, not just for a single therapy session with one person, but actually a ceremony circle with a dozen, 20 people holding all sorts of energy. And for me, of all the medicines, ayahuasca is my closest ally. And I've had really, really rich experiences through that particular path. And I'm curious if you've looked much into some of the indigenous traditions around ayahuasca. I know that you weren't familiar with iboga, but maybe peyote. And if you've seen anything around internal family systems through perhaps the lens of some of these indigenous wisdom traditions. Has that popped up at all?
Well, in the early days of developing IFS, you know, somebody said, you know, this sounds like shamanism. And So, and I had a close colleague at the time named Mitchie Rose, who was exploring that. And so we started to compare notes, and there were a lot of similarities. It is like we're going into the same world that they write about or they talk about. And we actually borrowed, like when we go to Unburden, I would ask your part what it wants to give it all up to, light, water, fire, wind, earth, or anything else. So, and that came from Mitchie's experience with shamanism and trying out the elements. So there are things that I incorporated. One of the biggest differences, as far as I can, you know, I'm not an expert on shamanism by any means, and I haven't tried the rituals myself. But from my understanding, one of the biggest differences is self. I haven't run into a shamanic training practice that knows about self in the way I do, in the way we do. And instead, they rely on spirit guides to do the retrievals, to do a lot of the heavy lifting in there, which works. I think it really does. You can unburden that way. But I have a big value on people coming to trust their self as a leader. And that doesn't necessarily do that. So that would be the biggest difference, probably.
Well, I would be fascinated to have a conversation with you after you have an ayahuasca experience. So if you ever choose to do that, in part because the experience that I've had and those often reported is that there does feel like there's another consciousness present in the space. Mm-hmm. I think with some people with psilocybin that as well, but I don't experience that with MDMA, of course, or ketamine or LSD. But with ayahuasca, it does feel like there is I have felt that there is a woman energy present, a grandmother energy that is a reciprocal consciousness. And I would be really interested to hear if you were to have that experience and how that might intersect with some of this deep study you've had of this system.
Yeah, I have interest in trying it at some point. I have a friend, Gabor Mate. Do you know that name?
I do, yes.
And he takes groups down to Peru every year and has been, you know, and keeps pushing me to do it. So one of these years I might do it.
With this current exploration of psychedelic therapy and IFS, I feel like at some point it'll call to you. I feel like at some point that'll be one to try.
I do too. And just while you're talking about that presence, we do encounter similar things in doing IFS occasionally. What we call guides will show up and you ask, are you a part? And they'll say, not exactly. And they're always very helpful. They very comforting, or they will do particular things or give particular pieces of advice, which has been a very curious, interesting phenomenon for me to study too over the years.
Yeah, I think that would be a really interesting experience for you. Mm-hmm. And I would just love to talk to you about it afterwards. Mm-hmm. So if you do,
okay.
I hope we could have another and possibly another recorded conversation sure. Just to hear about your process of learning about it.
Yeah, be happy to do that. Yeah.
So we're kind of getting towards the end of our conversation today, and I am so grateful for your time because I personally have gotten to learn a lot and I've gotten the benefit of your wisdom even just around my own personal life, which is great, great perk of the job. But as we're kind of beginning to come to a close here, I was wondering if you could take a moment to speak directly to a aspiring psychedelic therapist. And just what kind of advice might you give from all of the work that you've done? And you've talked a bit about this already, but I just want to open up the space for this. For someone who wants to be a guide in someone's exploration of their parts, what kind of advice would you give to someone to help them best prepare to be in that role?
Well, it's along the lines of what you were saying, which is to do their own work. So one, I'm intrigued with the parallels between the inner world and the outer world. And one of those is when someone is acting like one of your parts, you're going to relate to that person in the way you relate to that part of you.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. And hence the triggers too.
Exactly. So if you're trying to help facilitate And suddenly your subject gets very, very vulnerable and scared or sad or something like that. And you're afraid of your own exiles. Watching that person in that state is going to start to trigger your exiles. And it's going to be very hard for you to stay present with that person. Your protectors are going to take you out somehow. And that's not going to be good for your subject. So, or, you know, similarly, if you're afraid of your own anger or your own sexuality, in your case, initially, and some of that comes up, then you're going to check out. You're not going to be able to be present. So basically, I'm saying that people, you know, they don't have to do IFS, but do your own work so that when somebody's very, very vulnerable and sad, you can be with your own sadness without being afraid of it, simultaneous to being able to be with this person and their sadness.
You know, that actually makes me think of something here. I'm sure that you have been with a patient at some point with a subject, and you felt triggered in all the work that you've done.
Sure.
Of course, noticing that you're triggered is, of course, going to be the first step to anything, to coming into harmony. But what are some techniques you've used when you've personally been with someone, you've noticed yourself getting triggered? How do you come back into harmony to best support them? What kind of techniques do you use for that?
Yeah, so this is, again, a lot of our training. So first, let me say, I got triggered a lot in the beginning. And to my credit, I started to, instead of putting that on the client or being defensive when the client would call me on it, I started to really, what's this about? And take it to, I would trade sessions with another IFS therapist. And I would say, okay, this client really made me check out yesterday. I want to see what that's about. And I would go and we would find that part and we would heal it. And I'd come back, and now I could stay with the client. So I'm a very different person because I allowed my clients to trigger me. They became what we call my tormentors, with a hyphen between the tor and the mentor.
Ooh, I see what you did there. I like that.
So by tormenting me, they were mentoring me about what I needed to heal. And that's also the way I see my marriage. My wife is a fabulous tormentor. She gets and deserves a lot of credit for the improvements in me in the 12 years we've been hanging out together. So that's just another nice philosophy of anything that triggers you in a big way. There's an impulse to try and get the person to change. But if you instead do what we call a U-turn in your focus, and find the part that got triggered and stay with it, it can be a very, very healing experience for you.
It's so funny how our triggers are always such powerful teachers. I was once in an ayahuasca ceremony, and there's important decorum in an ayahuasca ceremony. You're supposed to dress in a certain way. There's just sort of ways that you're supposed to be. And a guy showed up, sit next to me. He was in cutoff jean shorts and a Metallica t-shirt. And he spent the ceremony just like babbling to himself, which is, you're just not supposed to do that. And so here I am trying to have my cosmic ayahuasca experience. And there's this guy who's just like, blah, 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 blah. And I spent the whole ceremony just like, just hating him. And by the end of the ceremony, I was like, oh, that was my ceremony. That was my lesson. And then I was on a plane shortly thereafter, and a baby started crying. And I had a similar thing where I was like, the baby's crying, get out. And I was like, oh.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
This is the thing.
Exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. Everything's a tormentor.
And you know what's funny? And I think this is a nice place to land our conversation. When we bring all these different aspects to ourselves into better harmony, it seems to free up energy. It seems to free up joy. You know, we've had this conversation. We've been speaking for a little over an hour. And of course, the point of the conversation is to serve the listener, but it's also serving me. And I'm finding myself just talking to you about this for about an hour. I'm like, I want to go on a hike. I want to go be out in the world. And I think that that's really the point of this healing, is like freeing up the energy that's keeping these different pieces of our psychology in these places because we think that's what's going to keep us safe. But it really ends up being our prison. Yeah. And then we free it up and it's like, oh, I want to go on a hike.
Yeah.
I want to go pick some wildflowers. I want to go out and expand.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what we feel in those psychedelic states too, is like the world is big. And you talked about the eight C's: connectedness, compassion, courage. That's the state that we most want to come into alignment with. And I'm so grateful for this modality that you've created, that before we'd never even met, and it's touched my life and definitely touching the lives of the people listening today. So thank you so much. And thanks for being on the show to talk about it.
Thank you, Amen. It's been delightful for me too. I feel very connected. And as you're saying, when you've got all these parts locked up, not only do they suffer, but you don't get their resources. You don't get their energy. And as both the exiles are released from exile and unburdened, and also the protectors are allowed to leave their, you know, confined roles, it frees up an enormous amount of energy. So what you're describing is not uncommon.
Well, I'm serious, man. I'm feeling some freed energy right now. I mean, we didn't do a session, but I am feeling like, you know, I'm feeling like I want to be expansive and out and in nature. And that's so much, you know, the work that we're doing to serve people is to get them out of these narrow, stuck perspectives that, you know, looping in resentment and pain, and really like remove the blinders and open up their ability to deeply connect with the world and those around them. And
yeah,
that's why these therapies are so important.
But the ironic thing about that is to loosen all that, you've got to go to it. You have to go to it first.
Mm.
And that's the mistake that so many spiritualities make, is thinking that let me get away from it because it's just the Maya, or it's just whatever derogatory word they have for it. Whereas the only way out is through. If you go to it, you can transform it. So that's what I'm trying to bring.
The only way out is through. Well, it has been such a pleasure chatting with you today. And what's the best way for people listening to follow your work? Obviously, people are familiar with your work, but what are you working on right now? Where should we point our listeners to at the moment?
Well, our website is ifs-institute.com. And most everything I do and we do is on there. I'm currently just finishing a book for Sounds True on IFS and spirituality.
Ooh.
Yet to be titled, but it's really been fun. Some of the ideas we've been talking about, the reason I'm fluent in them now today is because I've been sitting with them for almost a year and a half. So that's the next completed project, I hope. It's the deadline's in a couple of weeks.
Well, beautiful. I think a lot of our listeners will be interested in that subject matter. And so we'll have links in the show notes, and some of the things that were brought up in the podcast today we'll have in the show notes. Again, yeah, thank you so much. This has been a really enjoyable conversation and I've learned a lot.
Same for me, Amen. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.